You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, November 16th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, as promised, an extensive recap of the Democratic debate buried on a Saturday evening in Iowa during the NBA playoffs. Not playoffs, but big NBA games and some big college football. It was buried, ladies and gentlemen. We know it. Also on the program, obviously, the attack on Paris, allegedly by ISIS-trained terrorists. I think we're still waiting to see if it's actually the case it was ISIS, but it was clearly terrorists. Also on the program, the right-wing fallout from the attacks in Paris and the fallout from the Democratic debate. Ted Cruz, amnesty, of course, equals terrorist appeasement, and so on. We do have one poll from over the weekend. Donald Trump surging. I don't know what to tell you. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Let me start off by apologizing for my voice. Last night, my daughter and I went to the Patriots game where they beat the Giants. The Giants. And it was about as close a game as you can get. Pats ended up winning by 1 point with about 1 second remaining. And Mila was very, very intense during the game, and I had to bring up my game to be intense, to match her intensity. She still has a voice today. And all I can say is, and I'll talk more about it later in the show, we obviously got a lot of stuff to cover here, but it's a good thing that the Patriots were losing during much of the game, because she was, let me put this gently, because she is my 10-year-old daughter, incredibly obnoxious throughout the game. And fortunately, the Patriots were losing up until the last moments, more or less. And were it not for that, I don't know that people would have had the same measure of patience of her screaming at the top of her lungs, like, "You can do this, Gronk!"
Was it all like this, or was she also trash talking the Giants as well? Was she going after Manning?
Well, the thing, no, she didn't know who was on the Giants, but the thing that she started to do that I told her to stop doing was she started trying to trash talk the Giants fans.
Oh,
and
that's amazing.
That, you know,
what did she say? They are the worst.
Well, then she kept going like, "Sit down." And I'm like, "Sweetie, look around here. This is not everybody wearing those blue shirts. They're not Patriot fans.
Have some situational awareness."
Exactly.
And she's like, yeah, I know. So they should sit down.
And I got to say, like, football has become a little bit more drinky. And it now is a 4:30 in the afternoon game.
Wait,
so
when was it not drinky? Yeah. What are you talking about?
I just remember as a kid, there was a lot more, like, there seemed to be a lot more kids.
Oh, I see.
And maybe it was because it was a 4:30 game, but, you know. And Sullivan Stadium was smaller, and it was just not as amenable to, like, we're just going out to a club, essentially.
I did my first keg stand when I was 13 at a Patriots game in the parking lot. I mean, I think drinking has always been happening at these
things. Well, there's no doubt. Of course. Yeah. Of course. But
oh, and can I just say, one of our great fans tweeted at Sam and I last night with a funny gif of, it said Cheaties. It was a cereal box.
Yeah,
well, it's a Cheaties with Tom Brady. And
we'll have more to talk about the game, because there was some remarks from some Giants fans that are also say, worthwhile.
I wonder if you're butt hurt by that, buddy, by right. the result of that.
Of course. And I should say, you know, the reason why I also think there's more drinking is that a huge percentage of people go there by train, whereas in New England.
I mean, first of all, Mila sounds like a junior version of my sister who routinely is ejected from Steelers games by my dad, which is another story. But all the Steelers fans have to drive to the game, and they will start tailgating at 6 a.m. if the game is early enough. So it's drinky.
Okay. I don't doubt it. But imagine now if half of them didn't have to drive home.
I don't want to imagine.
All right,
that.
Exactly. All right, let's pick up with the debate here.
Global terrorism and a presidential
right,
debate.
Right, exactly. Obviously, the debate was impacted significantly by the terrorist attacks in Paris, and these were a big deal. These terrorist attacks. Tomorrow, Michael will have a guest on to address a lot of this more directly, and I think you obviously have the opportunity to get more reporting and news on this from other sources. All we can really do is sort of is read reports as they come in. I mean, the bottom line is that there were, as of now, authorities believe there were 8 people directly involved. One seems to have escaped, or they're not sure. They found a car with a couple of rifles in it and some empty cartridges, which suggests at least that somebody went back there, right, to the car after starting to shoot. 7 of the terrorists were EU-born. 1 had a Syrian passport. Six of them blew themselves up. They were supposedly wearing suicide vests, and supposedly these vests were identical. Now, I'm not quite clear on how that can be established, because presumably, right, they're destroyed. I mean, but they seem to have at least had similar circuitry. There was a sophistication in the tactics that supposedly experts say mirrors that of ISIS. There was a technique that was used that you see in places like Baghdad, specifically the one involving the football stadium. Apparently, a guy went into the football stadium, soccer stadium in our parlance, and was stopped going in because a security guard saw that the guy was wearing, saw something that made the assailant start to run the other way. Apparently, that security guard was Muslim, from what I understand. But that's just sort of a side note. That assailant or that suicide bomber then ran out of the stadium and ended up blowing themselves out in front of it. But apparently, the initial plan was to get that guy to go in, at least in partially into the stadium, so as to drive everybody out of the stadium. And then a second bomber would be out basically in the square as everybody was pulling out of there, and they were going to blow themselves up. That was the plan. And you see that in Baghdad. And I think we saw one of those in Tel Aviv, too, where they explode something and then wait for essentially
medical services to come in, and then they explode another one. So that's a, you know, these are the things apparently that experts use as indications as to sort of from where they got their training. My understanding too that the attacks in the concert venue where Eagles of Death Metal were playing, just sort of coincidentally, we often play them on the show. They, Janine and I interviewed them once in studio years ago on the old Majority Report, so we have them, but not a band that you would imagine. I mean, they're fairly popular, I guess, in Europe, but it's not. This is not a huge venue. There was another venue apparently around the corner, much bigger, but this was a softer target in some respects. There is some talk as to how these targets were not really particularly symbolic, at least in terms of politics per se. There's some talk that they represent some hedonism, supposedly. There's been there was talk of how during the time where there were bombings, I guess, coming from Algeria, that you can see this progression going from political targets to sort of cafes and then apparently maybe into outside of cities where there are even softer targets. But this remains to be seen. I mean, investigators will know more as we go forward. But it seems quite clear. I mean, nobody else has taken credit as far as I know. So it's, you know, and ISIS certainly has. So in many respects, that is, you know, that's almost all you need, right? They're going to get credit for it. They're going to get credit for it. And it's not necessarily, it's a slight change in tactics, but I guess we've seen this more and more, right? I mean, they are considered right now the downing of the Russian airplane in Egypt, a bombing in Beirut just a couple of days before Friday, which of course got very little attention, 50 people or so, 49 dead, I think, and some 200 odd injured. There's two ways to look at this. Some people say this is not necessarily an expansion of their, it doesn't mean that they're growing or getting stronger. It means that they are, resorting to this because perhaps they're stalling out a little bit in what they're doing. I mean, there's a strange dynamic that, where you have a tactic used by stateless terrorists, right? International terrorists, but they're also trying to establish a state simultaneously. And that may not work out very well for them because now we have, yes, and there was an attack, I think, in Turkey as well this past week or week and a half.
Oh, the one you're talking about, the one from like a month ago. That was truly the one that killed about 100 people at a peace rally.
Right, was that a full month ago?
That was about at least 3 weeks ago. That killed about 100 people at a peace rally.
So they're resorting to this more.
And there's even some questions, too, about the possibility that, you know, that this was a group affiliated with ISIS, but they sort of went ahead of the sort of leadership structure, essentially. So ISIS is claiming credit for it. And they're sort of happy it happened. But how tightly organized it was out of Syria is a really open question.
Right.
And that also poses questions about, as a result of them getting bombed and disrupted to a degree, is their sort of command structure breaking down a little bit and getting more diffuse? So maybe that's good news in Syria, where actually the Kurds had a really major victory last week, but really, you know, dangerous news in Europe, as an example, if these cells start to get activated.
Right. And if they're just sort of self-generating.
Right.
You know, And just coincidentally, my sister has a good friend who was in from Paris and had just was coming over to dinner as they came out of the subway and heard about the tax Friday night. And, you know, according to him, the country has been in not quite a state of emergency. I'm not quite sure what the translation is, but a high alert since at least January. And there's not a tremendous amount of civil liberties in the way that we contemplate them today. I mean, or at least technically. And so there was, you know, full on spying going on in France. I don't know how else to put that. And so it is sort of in some respects amazing that they pulled this off, because it involved a certain amount of coordination. Now, I'll tell you what I think one of the big differences is that the irony is in France, and Islam is the second largest religion in France. And the irony is that the Muslim community, according to polls anyways, take that, you know, obviously with a grain of salt, but the Muslim community in France perceives themselves as very, they have a very close relationship with French. They perceive themselves as integrated and are particularly patriotic when it comes, I guess, to their sort of their allegiance to France. However, non-Muslim French people have a very low regard for the French, for the Muslims, their Muslim population. There's a tremendous amount of anti-Muslim sentiment there. It is also fairly well known for their anti-Semitism in France, and to a certain extent, that may make it easier for people to for terrorists to sort of function in that world, right?
Because I mean, of the social isolation, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's and just really quickly to loop back for 1 second. In spite of all of the security crackdowns in France and the sort of heightened security alert, Turkey's come out and said that they actually warned France twice with specific regard to this.
Apparently, there were multiple warnings, not just from Turkey, coming out of Iraq. Yeah, right. I've seen the U.S. Supposedly issued a warning to them in September. I mean, there were multiple warnings here.
That kind of mirrors so many other situations where the sort of the crackdown on civil liberties and then at the same time missing intelligence tips.
Right.
That's a really common theme.
And, you know, I just recall that that story when we had the reporter from The Intercept, his name escapes me for the moment, on the story of the
Murtaza,
the Fort Dix Five. And if you recall, one of the people ultimately went to jail was for ostensibly buying arms illegally, had been approached by a Muslim. He himself is also Muslim. Had been approached by a Muslim who he thought was asking for things and looking to do things, and whatever it was, it set off some alarm bells. And he had a friend, this guy worked at a pizza place. He had a friend who was a cop who would come in. So he talked to the cop and he said, "Hey, you know, can you get word to the FBI? I think this guy is, there's something off about this guy and the thing he's talking about and this and that. I think he should be investigated." Now, it turned out that the guy who this Muslim guy who worked at a pizza place wanted investigated was in fact an FBI informant himself trying to set up the pizza guy. And it was the pizza guy who ended up going to jail. But that dynamic, I don't know if that works as well in France when a population is already sort of feeling like they are, you know, sort of in some way ghettoized and and hated by the majority for a number of reasons. I don't know. I mean, over the days and weeks to come, we'll obviously be talking to people who are more well-versed in these things. As for what happens with us next in terms of what we do, I hope it's not much. It would be good to maintain or increase support for refugees. Apparently, President Obama, good for him, is maintaining our goal of letting in, I think it's 60,000 refugees this year. It should be more, obviously, but we do have Republican states who are coming out and saying we're not going to take any Syrian refugees to varying degrees.
I think Alabama has flatly rejected.
Snyder in Michigan has said, well, we got to wait and see what the protocols are or some such nonsense. The guy in Massachusetts, the Republican, has said, well,
Charlie
I
Baker?
Also want, yes.
What a scumbag.
Exactly.
It's ridiculous. How could Massachusetts let, how could you do that?
And I think what we will see is more encouragement of regional players to get more involved. I think we're going to see, President Obama supposedly made some type of deal with Putin, which I think it's going to mean ultimately more civilian casualties on some level. When the French hit Raqqa, which apparently is well known as the ISIS, capital, as it were. The reason why there has not been attacks on that area is to minimize civilian casualties. And that seems to be, at least for the time being, there is, I think there is a sense in these governments that they can get away with more civilian casualties as a function of this. But there seems to be growing, at least consensus, that there, that the civil war in Syria needs to end and everybody's got to suck it up and put their sort of, I guess, their interests aside. So in other words, we may tell Russia, yeah, we're okay with Assad for now.
My sense would be, from what I've read, is that it's going to be like Assad specifically might be the sacrificial lamb. Get rid of him because let's not forget, he's killed, slaughtered so many people and committed so many human rights abuses that he definitely doesn't have the kind of legitimacy they're looking for, so that Russia might be willing to say, let's have an Assad government without Assad.
Right.
We've recalibrated and our priorities to have a secularist government. And so then they can coordinate against Al-Qaeda and ISIS and then have some type of diplomatic process, which is more genuine because we're not just sitting there demanding that, well, this guy has to go and nothing else can happen until that happens.
Right. I mean, I think everybody's going to sort of back off a little bit and good for us. We've just given Saudi Arabia another like $2 billion worth of weapons, which I'm sure will help the situation. Right. But, again, I don't think our involvement and we'll get into the debate now, but I said this in 2004 and probably in 2005 and probably every year since in some context or another. But Humpty Dumpty fell off the wall. I mean, that's basically it. When we invaded Iraq, we created a chain of events where not specifically this, but something like this was inevitable and unavoidable. I mean, I guess theoretically, we could have invaded Iraq and taken every asset that we had in terms of people and money and spent the next 20 years building it up there. And there'd be a Disney World there now. And but the fact is, it's not a question of just the de-bathification of the Iraqi army. I mean, that may have led specifically to this, but if we didn't debathify, it would have led to something just as heinous but slightly different. The bottom line is we went in there, we shattered an equilibrium, and we thought it's just going to organically heal itself. And maybe I'm not convinced that, you know, Dick Cheney is just like, yeah, there's going to be growing pains like at any. We lost 500,000 people in our Civil War, you know. And these people aren't even American. So
do you think he was even thinking that far ahead?
Yeah, I think it's quite possible. I don't believe that it's beyond. I think it's quite possible they sat there and said, look, there's obviously going to be growing pains, which is, you know, translates into a lot of people who are brown are going to die. And but at one point, maybe it's 20 years from now, maybe it's 25 years from now, there'll be an equilibrium because enough people have killed themselves or have been pushed out of the region or become refugees or whatnot. I mean, isn't that the Israeli plan for the West Bank, right?
That's right.
It's just there's just going to be enough mayhem that eventually, you know, it's growing pains. And so this is all baked into the cake. The idea that we could think that just the trillions of dollars and just the couple hundred thousand, depending on who's counting, Iraqi civilians was going to be the only cost of that world war and the destabilization was crazy. I mean, it turns out that apparently 90% of the members of ISIS in Iraq who are in Iraq are Iraqis. 70% of the fighters, the ISIS fighters in Syria are Syrians. So
it's a colonial force, essentially.
Well, the point being, if Iraq was not so destabilized,
right,
then whatever was going on in Syria would have been able to be contained by different forces. Maybe the moderates could have prevailed there,
right,
in the event that that was going to happen anyways. But because there's a sort of free flow back and forth, and because they have logistical support back and forth, and because, you've got Assad basically surrounded on some level, because they have a revenue coming from Iraq, all of these things conspire to the absolute crap show that we have now. So, Humpty Dumpty was broken, and we love to sort of think like there's some solution that we should be pursuing. If the problem is that is so destabilizing is the refugee problem, let's just deal with the refugee problem. But the idea that we can go in and, Lindsey Graham will lead a secret battalion of ex-military personnel and decathlon athletes and a whole range of superheroes.
Everybody,
we're going
Let's
in there.
This. We're
going
to do it. Oh, my Lord.
Boots on the ground.
Tom Collins, anyone?
Like, he's going to go in there and take care of the whole thing.
If he wants.
If only he was General Graham.
I would give him a shot if he wants to go in there.
All I need is 30 good men from South Carolina.
Just give me
and enough weapons in a plane transport, and I'll take care of I'll show those ISIS people a thing or two. Ben al-Baghdadi or whatever his name is, this is really hard, I think, for Americans to accept. But sometimes we can't do anything about it. And that's hard for people on the right to accept, and that's hard for people on the left to accept. We can't necessarily stop them from fighting. The best we can do if we're worried about refugees is to actually directly help the refugees. We can do that by taking more than 60,000, and we can do that by pouring cash into that region.
I think we should definitely still be arming and supporting the Kurds, for sure. And that is part of the picture. But I also think really briefly, the other thing, too, is that even after Al-Qaeda and the attacks on September 11th, I still think you had a lot of people like Dick Cheney going back to the 80s who really still somehow thought that, like, if some fanatical Sunni groups get empowered in the region and our allies are funding them, that's still preferable to Iran and preferable to Hezbollah. So I think in some ways they weren't even worried about that at all on a regional level. And that's another major major miscalculation and problem.
My sense was that, frankly, Dick Cheney wanted to make sure that we had enough of a presence in that region. So, in other words, if everything was to fall to crap in Saudi Arabia, we could just step right in.
I remember what, it's right. I remember what Petraeus said a couple of months ago, too. He said it's time. He actually floated that it's time for us to start directly funding Nusra. I mean, not ISIS, but Nusra, because Al-Qaeda and ISIS have been at odds in Syria. So even a couple years, I mean, literally after September 11th, you're already talking about a calculation because they're so fanatical about Iran and so short-sighted to actually give weapons to Al-Qaeda's prime affiliate in Syria.
I mean, I think there is also a big reason to believe that they just want to maintain, they could have like extended the Iraq-Iran war for another 15, 20 years and sucked the life out of both sides there. I think they would have done it. Yeah. And so, all right, let's go to the Democratic debate, because, I said earlier, in fact, I didn't even watch it live Saturday night. Well, I watched part of it live Saturday night. And then I watched the rest Sunday morning. No, I didn't even watch it live Saturday night. I delayed it because we had the movie night with Myla. She watched Star Wars for the first time.
Which one?
Well, I don't know what they call it now. Something of hope. But I just said it was number one for me.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. Yeah, the first Star Wars.
First Star Wars, which they now call the fourth Star Wars.
Whatever.
Give me a break. Anyway, try and explain that to a 10-year-old. All right, let's go move on to the debate here. It was held in Iowa. John Dickerson, CBS News. He was okay. But look, here's the overall assessment that I have, and we'll go through this. Bernie Sanders still has not been able to get to a place where he is drawing sharp enough distinctions between his policy sets and Hillary Clinton's. That is an ongoing problem. And there were opportunities which he missed to do so, and it's unfortunate. The one thing though that I think is coming out of this is that and it's partially just it's basically an unforced error by Hillary Clinton, it seems to me, is the issue of her relationship with Wall Street. But let's just touch on briefly. They of course at the beginning had to address. During this debate, they had to address the terrorist attack in Paris the night before. Here is Bernie Sanders talking about this dynamic, which we mentioned earlier, which is, look, Americans desperately want to do something about this. And on the left, it's because they don't want to see any more killing. On the right, in many respects, because they haven't seen enough killing. And that's the reality. But there's another answer, which is, how about we don't do anything in terms of trying to stop the civil war? Because every time we try and do something like that, we actually create more war. If we are really concerned with the refugee crisis, let's focus on the refugee crisis. Here's Bernie Sanders saying, the fact of the matter is, despite the fact that Hillary Clinton wants to say, like, look, none of this stuff, and it's not like the Iraq war was responsible for 9/11. 9/11 happened before the Iraq war. And Bernie says, well, okay, if you want to take a long view of this, our invasion of Iraq was also not the first time we've meddled in this type of stuff with blowback. Here's number one.
Senator, let me just follow this line of thinking. You criticized then Senator Clinton's vote. Do you have anything to criticize in the week?
Now, one of the problems I had with John Dickerson was that he spoke so quickly.
Senator Sanders, let me just follow this line of thinking. You've criticized then-Senator Clinton's vote. Do you have anything to criticize in the way she performed as Secretary of State?
I think we have a disagreement. The disagreement is that not only did I vote against the war in Iraq, if you look at history, John, you will find that regime change, whether it was in the early 50s in Iran, whether it was toppling Salvador Allende in Chile, whether it is overthrowing the government of Guatemala way back when, these invasions, these toppling of governments, regime changes, have unintended consequences. I would say that on this issue, I'm a little bit more conservative than the secretary.
All right.
And that I am not a great fan of regime change.
Senator, let me go.
Yeah, now that's really important. And one of the more substantive things that came out of this debate, and one of those things that what I'm talking about, like, you know, Bernie Sanders needs to go even further with this stuff. And he needs to go do this stuff in the financial realm as well. Basically saying, like, look, you can pretend that, well, this terrorism came out of nowhere in 2001 because they hate us for our freedoms. But the reality is that we've created a lot of turmoil in the world. Maybe that wasn't our intention. But we intervened in a lot of places. And it just so happens that in the Middle East, unfortunately for us, whereas, you know, in Latin America, where we got involved in these things, there wasn't as much blowback because, frankly, the stakes weren't as high insofar as, I mean, it was for people who lived there, but there was nobody else pouring cash in there. There were no other proxy wars between different states that wanted to demonize us, you know, more than just the general population felt that we were responsible for things. And we're doing this in the Middle East. We do it in a powder keg. So that was a good moment for Bernie, I thought. Now we move into the area where John Dickerson wants to carry a little water for the right in this country and for basically, you know, some nominally on the left who want to demonize Islam. One of the best things I have to say that George Bush did, maybe the only, maybe there's a couple, was that he made it clear to Americans after 9/11 that Islam was not the enemy. And in many respects, maybe that's why it's so difficult to pull off a terrorist attack in this country. Because things like Islamophobia, for the most part, Pam Geller notwithstanding, have been kept to a minimum in this country. Well, here's Hillary Clinton being asked this word, and this is the big gotcha moment if you're a conservative. Here it is.
Secretary Clinton, you mentioned radical jihadists.
Yes.
Marco Rubio, also running for president, said that this attack showed, and the attack in Paris showed, that we are at war with radical Islam. Do you agree with that characterization, radical Islam?
I don't think we're at war with Islam. I don't think we're at war with all Muslims. I think we're at war with jihadists who have...
Just to interrupt, he didn't say all Muslims. He just said radical Islam. Is that a phrase you don't...
I think that you can talk about Islamists who clearly are also jihadists, but I think it's not particularly helpful to make the case that Senator Sanders was just making, that I agree with, that we've got to reach out to Muslim countries, we've got to have them be part of our coalition. If they hear people running for president who basically shortcut it to say we are somehow against Islam, that was one of the real contributions, despite all the other problems, that George W. Bush made after 9/11 when he basically said, after going to a mosque in Washington, we are not at war with Islam or Muslims. We are at war with violent extremism. We are at war with people who use their religion for purposes of power and oppression. And yes, we are at war with those people, but I don't want us to be painting with too broad a brush.
The reason I ask is that you gave a speech at Georgetown University in which you...
Okay, she could be more explicit, and you can just cut out those things. You don't have to fade it out. She can be more explicit here, which is just like, look, we're not at war with Islam or any type of Islam. We're not at war with Sunni Islam. We're not at war with Shia Islam. We're not at war with even fundamentalist Islam. Because it is a derivation. It is a bastardization of that religion. Any more than we're at war with, you know, white supremacists. No, we're at war with racism and bigotry in this country or tactics, frankly. And so, but this is a big deal on the right. And it's one of those things where it really functions and hopefully the former Secretary of State will figure this out so that she doesn't have to fumble through this. Because Obama's actually been quite good on this in many respects. You cannot fumble about in this answer. because this on the right is basically, sort of Benghazi-like. They'll talk about this and they'll think, like, we have got Hillary Clinton now. She's not saying radical Islam. And in their minds, they think this is the golden key. We're going to nail her in a debate where she won't say radical Islam. They're in such a bubble. They think this is a big deal. And so she's got to be able to make sure that it doesn't become about her stammering and sort of dancing around something. Just answer the question. No, we're not involved. We're not at war with any type of Islam. We're at war with people who have bastardized Islam or are using it, taking its name in vain, whatever. That's who we're at war with, the people who are actually doing and committing atrocities. All right, moving on. Here is Martin O'Malley. And, you know, the more I see of O'Malley, I got to say, sort of the less impressed I am by this guy. I don't know what it is. He's just not. There's something, I don't know. There's something that, I don't know. I just don't.
You know what he does that I think we'll see in this clip that we're about to play? Every time he gets a good line in, and sometimes he does, you know, he's not an idiot. He knows how to deliver
something.
He
seems like a smart guy. That's the thing.
Smart guy, you know, knows how to talk. But he does this weird, like, thing where he kind of, like, he says he gets in a line, and then he kind of, like, scans the room with a dumb smile on his face. Like, did you see that?
Right.
Did you see what I just did? That was good. It's very awkward.
It's awkward. And I say this, and I don't generally, you know, I don't spend a lot of time, I think, you know, sort of, there's just something I find sort of untrustworthy about him, and I don't know why, and it's completely.
Is it because of The Wire?
You know.
On some level.
Probably.
Yeah.
Probably, although I have to say, I was more open to him. Like, I actually feel like I like that guy who played Carcetti or whatever his name is more than I like him.
Well, he was a lot more kind of, he didn't have this kind of goofy thing that O'Malley has.
Yeah, there's some goofy thing. But, okay, with that said, here is O'Malley trying to call out Donald Trump. And remember now, if you're O'Malley, you are running in your mind for Hillary's vice president. And so what you got to do is you got to show, like, I can be an attack dog. It's sort of, there's a little bit something labradoodle about him. This is Martin O'Malley talking about Donald Trump.
Candidates, we've already heard your answers on what you would do with Syrian refugees. But a crucial part of the immigration debate here at home is control of our own borders.
Pause it.
Republicans say
that. I should just say that this is Kevin Cooney, who's one of the moderators. Good.
Borders, securing borders is a top priority. Democrats say they want to plan for comprehensive immigration reform. So, Governor O'Malley, are you willing to compromise on this particular issue to focus on border security first in favor of keeping the country safer?
Well, Mr. Cooney, we've actually been focusing on border security to the exclusion of talking about comprehensive immigration reform. In fact, if more border security and more deportations were going to bring our Republican brothers and sisters to the table, it would have happened long ago. The fact of the matter is, and let's say it in our debate, because you'll never hear this from that immigrant-bashing carnival barker, Donald Trump, the truth of the matter is... The truth of the matter is, net immigration from Mexico last year was zero. Fact check me. Go ahead, check it out. But the truth of the matter is, if we want wages to go up, we've got to get 11 million of our neighbors out of the off-the-book shadow economy and into the full light of an American economy.
Yeah, I mean, there's O'Malley, and he got off the carnival barker line. A lot of that stuff sounded pre-planned. Donald Trump responded, Hillary and Sanders are not doing well, but what is the failed former mayor of Baltimore doing on that stage? O'Malley is a clown, says Donald Trump. But good for him for watching the debates.
He's so good, too. He also loves how he's just like, all right, I don't have time to say he was also a failure as governor because of character limit.
You know, that's the thing. I got to hand it to Trump. I mean, you know.
Yeah, you regularly do.
I got to hand it to him. He's got a lot of 140 candidates, 140 characters. He really gets a lot conveyed. All right, let's move on to the economics part of the debate. Here is a Bernie on minimum wage. And, you know, some of these places are places where I think that Sanders just does not go far enough. And, you know, we had talked with Digby, I guess it was a week ago, following following the prior Friday's Democratic forum, and suggested that Bernie needs to come up with proposals that maybe are actually pushing the conversation a little bit further along, and ones that really expose the differences between himself and Hillary Clinton. Here he is on the minimum wage. This is clip number 4.
It is not a radical idea to say that if somebody works 40 hours a week, that person should not be living in poverty. It is not a radical idea to say that a single mom should be earning enough money to take care of her kids. So I believe that over the next few years, not tomorrow, but over the next few years, we have got to move the minimum wage to a living wage, $15 an hour, and I apologize to nobody for that.
You said there are consequences. You said there are consequences for any policy. Do you think job losses are a consequence?
This is what I think.
Accepting?
This is what many economists believe. That one of the reasons that real unemployment in this country is 10%, one of the reasons that African-American youth unemployment and underemployment is 51%, is the average worker in America doesn't have any disposable income. You have no disposable income when you're making 10, 12 bucks an hour. When we put money into the hands of working people, they're going to go out buy goods, they're going to go out buy services, and they are going to create jobs in doing that. That is the kind of economy I believe. Put money in the hands of working people. Raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour.
Kathy, this was not merely...
Now, okay, he's got to get sharper on this answer. Obviously, what he's saying is correct, but he's not doing the majority report right now and have time to do... He's got to say, what you just said about job loss is a lie. And whenever you hear a conservative say there's going to be job loss, you should know that they're lying. The idea that people can work a 40-hour week in this country and not make 30 grand a year, even a couple years out from now, is ludicrous. You say it's a lie, and the reason why it's a lie, because this is a consumer-driven economy, and when you put more money into the pockets of workers, you're putting more money into the pockets of consumers, and they expand the economy and they create jobs, period. He's just going to go straight on it because he knows he's going to get this question. All right, let's go and I want you to listen to the moderators on this too. The moderators editorialize sort of fantastically on this. This is Bernie on how he'll raise taxes. And, well, here, just keep an eye out for, I can't remember what the woman's name who was one of the moderators. She was from, I think, the Iowa paper or something. Go ahead.
In the last 30 years, there has been a massive redistribution of wealth. And I know that term gets my Republican friends nervous. Problem is, this redistribution has gone in the wrong direction. Trillions of dollars have gone from the middle class and working families to the top one-tenth of 1% who have doubled the percentage of wealth they now own. Yes, I do believe that we must end corporate loopholes such that major corporations year after year pay virtually zero in federal income tax because they're stashing their money in the Cayman Islands. Yes, I do believe there must be a tax on Wall Street speculation. We bailed out Wall Street. It's their time to bail out the middle class, help our kids be able to go to college tuition free. So we pay for this by due demanding that the wealthiest people and the largest corporation who have gotten away with murder for years start paying their fair share.
Well, let's get specific. How high would you go? You've said before you'd go above 50%. How high?
We haven't come up with an exact number yet, but it will not be as high as the number under Dwight D. Eisenhower, which was 90%. But it will be. I'm not that much of a socialist compared to Eisenhower. But we are going to end the absurdity, as Warren Buffett often reminds us.
That's right.
That billionaires pay an effective tax rate lower than nurses or truck drivers. That makes no sense at all. There has to be real tax reform, and the wealthiest and large corporations will pay.
Okay, so I think it was Kathy Obradovich. But nevertheless, you could hear her at one point say, well, hope so. Now, understand, too, the thing that's not being communicated here is that it's not 50% of all the money a wealthy person earns. It's not 50% of a millionaire's income. It is 50% over a certain amount that they earn. So they pay the same taxes for their first $30,000. They pay a lower rate for their first $100,000. And then when you start getting up around $200,000 or whatever the point is, they pay more on every dollar afterwards. That is called a graduated income tax. And the idea that even these reporters don't know what that means is absurd. And then you had Martin O'Malley just sort of go, uh-huh. Can I get in here?
Hey, can I get in on this? We should have a higher wage. Oh, man, he's so out of it. I haven't even bothered to even attempt the beginnings of an impression of that guy.
Other than
staring around the room with a dumb smile on my face expecting.
I don't think he's going to go very far.
What'd you say?
I don't think he's going to go very far.
No.
This is new producer Matt with a message for our freebie listeners. This has been a teaser edition of the Majority Report. To hear the rest of our coverage of the second Democratic debate, become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com.